A Power Struggle. Hi, this is Zdravko Stefanovic from Walla Walla University School of Theology. Welcome to Good Word, our weekly radio program that focuses on biblical topics and discussions. Today we are continuing a series of topics based on one of the less known books of the Bible, the Book of Numbers. And to help me in this task, I have invited two of my colleagues to be my guests. Dr. Paul Dibdahl, Professor of Religion here at Walla Walla University, and Dr. Kyle Craig, Professor of Chemistry at Walla Walla University. Gentlemen, welcome again.
Thank you.
For the topic of today, Power Struggle. We are focusing on chapters 16 and 17 of the Book of Numbers. And allow me to read the first three verses from that chapter. Korah, son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, became insolent and rose up against Moses. With them were 250 Israelite men, well-known community leaders who had been appointed members of the council. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" So just to remind ourselves that Moses, he himself was from the tribe of Levi. And Moses' brother Aaron was in charge of the priesthood in Israel at that time. So here we have another example of power struggle within, not necessarily one family in a narrow sense of the word, but within the tribe, some descendants from Levi. Let's look at the issue here. The first question, Korah and his followers wanted more people to be dedicated as priests. Was there a need for a greater number of priests in Israel at that time, or what was at stake?
Do we know if there was a need or not? Because I don't know.
Do you think that was the reason?
Probably not.
No. People always have some overarching sort of pseudo-reason that they present as, well, this is the real reason I'm doing this, but it's not.
But it is tempting to view spiritual positions in this way, as positions of power.
Sure.
And then the next step is that some people begin to covet those positions because they like power. I don't know how much we would like to judge Korah, but definitely if we would like to apply today, sometimes these things do happen. They drive people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate, but this kind of struggle continues on. I think in every corner of society, including in church. And it's maybe most discouraging there because we would hope or expect better behavior from religious leaders. But there's no question about it that people still strive for power and influence.
So the human element is present in religion and sometimes. Yeah,
unfortunately, I mean.
Another question is that by using the words "the whole community," did the leader of the opposition try to speak for all the people?
It's common for people to say that. Everyone knows that your class is so hard or, you know, whatever, you know, and they talk about that kind of thing, or everyone thinks that's not fair. And I think
they're exaggerating.
It's kind of exaggeration.
Well, yeah, and
the more
some
people on your side, the more your case sounds like it's legit, whereas if it's just, you know, the few people mentioned here with the 250 Israelite men.
So a parent will come to the teacher and say, several of us have been talking about this situation, and the several would be me and my spouse, and maybe that's it. Right. We want to marshal, like you said, you know, pretend that there's this great, great wellspring of support for our position. It's a way of buttressing our own view.
Yeah, it just makes you, I think it also gives you comfort yourself because.
Oh, yeah.
It provides you with like, well, yeah, all these other people are going to agree to me when they hear that I've done this, they're going to jump up and say, yeah, we like that idea too.
One of my favorite examples from the Bible on this is Daniel 6, In that chapter, we find Daniel to be one of the three top administrators over the satraps. And definitely that the king saw in Daniel the leader, uh-huh. even of the three of them. But then we have the jealous administrators coming before the king, and they say all of the administrators and satraps and everybody has agreed that the following law should be put into force and so on. And definitely that all did not include Daniel.
Yeah.
We can be sure of that.
Yeah.
So this power struggle ended in a very sad way. And that is that the situation was getting out of control and God had to perform one of what is known from the Bible, one of his strange acts, and that is to allow destruction to come upon his people, severe punishment. And verses 46 through 48, they talk that even at that point, Moses and Aaron, they did not give up on the idea of trying to reduce the damage. And Moses says to Aaron, take your censer, put incense in it, along with fire from the altar, and hurry to the assembly to make atonement for them. Wrath has come out from the Lord. The plague has started. And this is apparently what Aaron did. And Aaron stood between the living and the dead, and the plague stopped. So, again, the leaders of God's people were interceding in behalf of the people before God to preserve their lives.
Which is meaningful because this is the punishment for the rebellion and complaining against them as leaders, and yet they step in to try to preserve the lives of those who have been against them. So yeah. this is a positive thing that we see.
Right.
In them.
But then what surprises us is that the rebels are punished before the eyes of the people, and the people still complain against God. They have been eyewitnesses. The people have been eyewitnesses of the punishment on Korah and his followers. Why do they then begin to grumble against Moses and Aaron?
I looked at this again. I read your question before. And so why do they grumble against Moses and Aaron again? They say, well, because so many people have died. And they blame Moses. You have killed the Lord's people, they say. So there's just no way to win. They complain against Moses, the plague falls, and they still complain against, well, you did it. A failure to see their own part in the punishment that has come. Mm-hmm. It's always somebody else's fault.
And then we come to one of those instances in the Pentateuch or in the Bible where God spells out a very harsh verdict. And Moses, in this case, being God's representative, a prophet, he intercedes before God for his people. So is Moses described here as more compassionate than God himself? Kyle?
I almost see this as a test for Moses. Mm-hmm. Because, as Paul, you just described it, the people are angry. And they come through Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and they, get very excited against Moses. And then God wipes out a bunch of people, and then people are still upset. The logical thing for Moses at that point would be to say, yeah, God, take them all. Just, make sure you get me back somewhere where there's civilization. But, yeah, they're yours. Bye. And Moses doesn't do that. So I think it's kind of a test of God, almost to me in a sense of, the same sort of test as Abraham offering Isaac. That almost sounds completely against what God would be all about. Offer your own son. And here, again, it's, I think, the same sort of thing. Hmm. Something where Moses is expected to come out looking more compassionate than God, even though he's not. Because God knew what he was going to do, but it was a test for Moses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I would say is that the Lord is the one who stops the plague.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to argue that the Lord isn't being compassionate, mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. it would be difficult to do mm-hmm. because he responds to human appeal, which I think is an act of mm-hmm. grace and compassion mm-hmm. from the Lord.
So. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I do agree that he gives a chance to the human beings to mm-hmm. show compassion. And this certainly reminds us also of Abraham's intercession in behalf of the cities of the plain.
Uh-huh.
And twice he uses a very strong term used in the Middle East, and that is Halilah, or far it be from you that you would do such a thing, and so on. And, of course, asking that famous rhetorical question, will not the judge of the whole earth do justice? And so on. So God allows people to demonstrate that type of compassion. And because that's what his character is all about. And one more question on this passage. Can you see any figurative or spiritual meaning in Aaron's ministry between the living and the dead? Someone who steps forward and stands between the living and the dead in order to save, in order to rescue. Are we allowed to read this much into the text, Paul?
Is this another connection with something which comes later in the Bible, huh? Well, certainly it's a kind of salvific, salvific imagery, a salvation imagery.
Because it was a solemn responsibility for Aaron. His own life was at stake to hold that censer right on the line between the dead and the living.
He places himself
in jeopardy.
He offered
his life. Yes, and definitely that, this picture certainly reminds us of a number of New Testament passages where we have Christ doing that very thing, and that is offering himself to intercede in behalf of those who are destined to die in order to help them remain alive and preserve their lives.
Which is kind of interesting to me that it's Aaron that's doing that, because Moses is presented as, having similar attributes to Christ, but here it's Aaron that's standing in the spot between the living and the dead, standing in the gap, I guess would be a way to phrase it. And so to me, that's always been a very interesting detail in the story.
Now let's not forget that Aaron and his family, they were the target of this attack. And in the end, Aaron, has a function that basically puts him at risk.
And also it's a second chance, because we talked a few weeks back about how Moses and Aaron spoke against Moses, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, and now God's like allowing Aaron to have a second chance.
Well, we conclude by reminding ourselves that love of power can easily lead to corruption.
Always leads to corruption, maybe, huh?
Well, I would like to thank both of my guests, Paul Dibdahl and Kyle Craig, for their contribution to our discussion today. And also, I'm grateful to Susan Michael, our radio technician, for her expertise today. Please join us next week as we continue to explore the messages from the biblical book of Numbers. I would like to thank all of you for tuning in. For Good Word, I'm Slavko Stefanovic.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.